You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
This is Ashley Winch in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
And I'm Kat Gunther from White Lake, Michigan. You're listening to the Quarter Horse Podcast for October 21st. Good morning, Horse World.
You're listening to the Quarter Horse Podcast, where we explore the versatility of the world's most popular breed of horse, the American Quarter Horse.
Well, Kat, I am so excited, as always, to sit with you today and record the Quarter Horse Podcast. This is my funnest time of the month. And yes, that's a word. Catch me outside.
Catch me outside. How about that?
And this episode specifically, I'm super stoked about. We have two inspirational, incredible riders. Talk about like overcoming incredible hurdles. We're so excited to get into that later. But first, it's kind of a big deal happening right now in the quarter horse world.
Yeah, the Quarter Horse Congress is going on. I think it started end of September and goes till the end of
October. It goes on forever.
It does. I remember when I would go there, I'd be there for 2 weeks at a time. And some people, like, you think the vendors, the food vendors, all of them, they're there the whole month.
Imagine if you're showing that long, like if you're actively in class, like that's a huge, huge commitment.
Oh, yeah. I remember I'd have like one class on a Monday, then the next would be on the following Tuesday. So I would be there the entire 2 weeks just showing the all-around classes. But some people, if they just come for the reining, just come for the jumping, they're in and out. It really depends what you're doing. But a lot of the trainers are there for at least 3 weeks.
Oh, my gosh. And this is in Ohio. So it's not exactly a destination, should we say?
Yeah, it's the Ohio State Fairground. So it's right near Columbus, Ohio.
Right. So that's where we were for Equine Affair.
Yeah, same spot. Mm-hmm. It's surrounded by a bit of a sketchy area, as you saw. So you can't really venture outside too much. But I mean, it's not all that bad. Congress is a magical time of year.
I know. So tell me more about your experience at Congress. Like, how old were you when you went? Like, what was that like? Just for someone who has no idea what Congress is.
Yeah, so it's the world's largest single breed horse show. It is massive, as you can tell from what we're saying. But the first time I ever went to Congress, I was maybe 11, and we were watching a friend of ours compete. And I just thought, wow, I love this. That was right when the horse show bug really bit me. And I didn't show at Congress until I was maybe 15. I only showed one class. It was a horse I bought 3 weeks before we went and showed.
Oh, my gosh, Teddy.
No, that was a horse named Ty.
Oh, Ty. Yeah. Ty has entered the chat.
I entered the chat. He was a menace in the worst possible way.
Like, no. That horse
toss his head in the air and run. And little old me was just happy to be there, but it was actually scary. Love Ty. What a great one. All love to Ty, but that was a very scary moment of my life.
You know, they all teach us something, right?
Really? You know, that horse was so good at the showmanship, but you put a saddle on and tried to get him to do like ack or something.
Not happening.
No. But Teddy, I bought, all the years blend together. The first time I showed him in Congress, though, it was 2018.
Okay.
And we did the all-around classes. I remember I got third in, like, the novice 14 to 18 egg, and that was just the most wonderful
the best,
moment.
The best yellow ribbon you've ever received,
best
I'm sure.
Ribbon. Oh, my gosh. My mom has a video of me from the stage just, like, crying when they called my name. So that place is very special to me and has a lot of really good memories.
Oh, I love it. And I know a lot of our guests that we've had on recognize you from Congress over the years. Like a couple episodes ago when we had Katie Van Slyke on, she was like, oh, I remember you and Teddy. And I just think it's so cool that your reputation precedes you.
Thank you, Ashley. Teddy was definitely a superstar back in his day. So that's everybody knew me because of Teddy, essentially.
We love that.
Yeah, no, he was a quirky little man. Everybody's heard my stories on here about how quirky Teddy was. Absolute love of my life.
I just love that you have special memories at Congress. You know, it really is such a defining moment, I think, for a lot of quarter horse riders and horses themselves to be in those arenas and in those spaces where the greats have been. And, you know, it's just, it truly is a special memory. Kat, tell me, are there other shows that kind of run off of Congress? Like, where are the next steps?
I think there's a big paint show going on at some point, but as far, I know the quarter horse stuff. So sure. I know the quarter horse, the amateur and the amateur select world are coming up in November.
Okay.
And are planning to compete at the select world.
That's right. They are. And I'll just take that segue and run. The legacy of the American Quarter Horse is built on heart, versatility, and the unwavering bond they share with their riders. But few pairs exemplify this spirit like Teresa Goforth and her partner, Maverick. At a combined age of 95 years, 75-year-old Teresa and her 20-year-old Quarter Horse just qualified for the Run for a Million Non-Pro Challenge, one of the most elite reining competitions in the world. As one of the oldest horse and rider duos to ever compete at this level, they don't just defy stereotypes. They prove that the true measure of an incredible quarter horse owner-rider is found in the deep partnership, longevity, and sheer, unyielding dedication to the ride. Teresa, a lifelong horsewoman, is showing the world that excellence and the best quarter horse stories truly have no age limit. Welcome to the show, Teresa.
So, Teresa, what did it feel like to compete at the Run for a Million?
It was like Hollywood, Hollywood all the way. When you go into that arena and they call out your name, they call out your horse's name, and the music was so loud. I mean, ear-busting loud. But it was more like it was no show I have ever been to was glitter and glitz, and there was a lot of people there. You know, you got a reining show. There's never anybody in the stands. And they clapped for me. They clapped for me. My video had run just before my class, just before I went in. And so they all knew who I was before I even went in there. But it was cool. It was really cool. Just the fact of being there and being able to show.
Absolutely. That's what Kat and I were just talking about before we had you on, is just the legend of riding in that arena, you know, where the greats have been. So, Teresa, tell me, how would you describe your unique partnership that you've built with Maverick? How did you get to where you are?
When I first bought him at six, and it was a slow, you know, how you get to know a horse. You know, when you first buy a horse, then you ride and ride and ride, go to shows and shows. And I had one of those trainer coaches that when he took all the non-pros to a show, you entered every single show of every class of the show. And you went to every show. I mean, we were ancillary, kings. So, because we went to every single one, and it was, you get to know your horse, you get to know what they do, you get to know all about them. And you came right before there was a show, you'd come out 3-4 times a week, which was hard because I had to change my schedule so much. I was a flight attendant for 50 years. And so in between flights, I'd be driving from DFW up here to North Texas, you know, to ride. But you really got into it. And I was very fortunate to have the perfect coach trainer. I had Terry Thompson, and I was with him until he retired, and then he kicked me out. But it was, I was the last stronghold, but he was the perfect person because he just had non-pros. He didn't show himself in the quarter horse. He showed other horses and everything before, but with us, it was all about us and the non-pro. And that really made you focus. And if there was some tweak or whatever, well, then, you know, back at home, we'd be, do it again, do it again, do it again. And you get to know your horse. And he even thinks this, you know, still to this day, the best horse, you know, for anything. So he's my one in a lifetime horse.
Oh, I love to hear that. So what kind of daily training routine do you usually do with Maverick to keep him in his tip-top shape at his age?
number one, we started, when we started legging back up for all of this, lots of supplements, you know, the Bone Care, the XL, the Gut X, he has a issue with sweating. So we have sweat medicine. We give him everything to take care of every issue so that he won't, you know, there won't be any problems for him. And every morning I'm now getting up. I'm a late sleeper from being a flight attendant. So
you're now, allowed now. You deserve it.
But with after the Run for the Million show, and you know, we kind of like, oh well, he's not exactly doing everything I want him to do like we did, you know, with us. He kind of did a few things that he took advantage of me. And so now I have Brent Lowski, you know, the colt company. He's, you know, the breeder and trainer. And he has me up at 7 o'clock every morning on Maverick, because it's cooler in the mornings on Maverick. And we're working on things. We're even going to go to the Southwest next week, which is just up the road, you know, at Ardmore, and do some schooling. We're going to go to quite a few classes and do some schooling, because, you know, he hasn't been in an arena really in 4 or 5 years. And the one show I went to qualify for the Run for the Million and for the Select World, and then the Run for the Million. I mean, that's the only time he's been in the arena. So we need to get him in the arena, get him a little more, you know, do what I want him to do rather than, you know, oh, I don't feel like doing that today, you know.
It's always the older geldings, I swear. They have their ideas. My show horse was 20-some years old when I showed.
I know.
That helps lead me into my next question, though. What advantages do you feel your years of experience have given you over younger competitors?
Well, I know every pattern by memory. I know every pattern, how to lead into the pattern, how to, you know, how to fix something if you're, you know, cutting short, do this and do that. I mean, I've got all of that. Riding is fun. Riding is fun. It's, you know, more so than any of the other events. And the, I just think I have, you know, it's routine. It's pretty routine. And there's always ways to, you know, I don't stress on anything, you know, I'm not nervous. So that's a good thing. You know, I've got the, all those years I've been in the arena.
I think that's so wise. I similarly, you know, I'm in my mid to late 30s, we'll say, and what I used to care about before I went in the arena is not even on the list anymore. You know what I mean? Teresa, what would your message be to older women, or anyone for that matter, who believes that their prime for competition is behind them?
Saddle up. And if you need help, have somebody saddle for you. If you can't get on the horse, get a ladder. I think a lot of it is fear. Their fear, too, that they're not going to do it right. Fear they're going to fall off. Feel they're going to, you know, all of it's the fear, and do it. I mean, what if you don't fall off? What if you, you know, do well? What if, you know, there's all that other if stuff. In between all the showing, I've been taking Maverick out on trail rides. There's a group of ladies in my area that are called 40-something cowgirls, and they're all older ladies that don't show. They all love trail rides. And so we've been just, you know, meeting up somewhere at trails or wine. You know, a lot of the wineries around here have trail rides.
Sign me and up. So I'm ready.
And take your horse. You take your horse and you ride a couple of hours on their trails and then come back and have a glass of wine and lunch and go out and ride an hour or two more. So we've been out doing things. And the only thing about Maverick is that if it's water, he will not touch it. Even if there's a water on the concrete, he will not touch it. So that's my only, you know, thing that I have issue with him. And if there's a ditch, you know, that has water in it, we're not going over it.
So, well, like, we all have our thing, right? And Mavericks is just water. And thankfully, I don't think you run into too many water obstacles in raining.
That's right. That's right.
Teresa, I was really excited to learn this next part about you. Beyond the arena, you have a heart for our servicemen and women, flying over 46 missions as a volunteer for the Civil Reserve Air Fleet post 9/11 and co-founding a crisis response nonprofit for combat veterans. This speaks to my family, or my heart, as we are a military family, and a couple of our other hosts on Horse Radio Network are also military families. And so first, I just wanted to thank you for your beautiful heart for supporting our men and women in service. And I wanted to ask you, how does that courage and commitment from that chapter of your life lend itself to your talents in the arena on horseback?
Oh, how does it connect? You do things. You don't have, it's like back to that fear. You don't have fear because flying, when you're flying in combat zones, you know, you don't have fear.
You don't have time to have fear.
You don't have time to have fear.
Yeah.
And it's just, you want to help others. I'm from a military family. My dad was a Navy pilot. My brother was in the Navy. My husband was a Marine. And so it's just, you know, the military, my cousin was a helicopter pilot during Vietnam and was killed over there. But I've always loved the military and I've always loved the soldiers and I've always had soldiers on my flying. I started flying in 1971. And during the flying, you know, I would always have soldiers. I did a couple of trips, Vietnam for the Vietnam veterans during that time and during Desert Storm. But then I really got a lot of the trips, you know, when OEF and OIF started after 9/11. And then looking at all of that, and we would stay in Germany over in between the trips and have go to the hospitals and visit them and the chaplains that were there. And we'd, after taking the soldiers over to combat zones, you get to know them. You know, you're on the airplane with them, you know, almost 20 hours. And so you get to know them. You would follow them. Sometimes you'd have them coming back when you'd bring back, you know, and, you know, after a couple of years, you'd bring them back, or after 6 months or whatever their term, you know, deployment was. And you'd just follow them along. And then you get to think, to know all the things that they need at the hospitals. And so we started sloughing things over there, you know, bags and bags of, you know, socks, underwear, t-shirts, things that they need when they come back to the hospital. And that's when I started the nonprofit, because no one, the companies wouldn't donate unless you were a nonprofit. And then I started meeting more and more of the counselors and stuff. And they said they needed, you know, with the PTSD. And I was familiar with PTSD because my husband was a Marine and had two terms over in Vietnam. And so I was familiar with it, but I didn't know what it was. And I learned about it. And so I went to Ross Perot, and he was all on board with me and gave me $1 million and said, here, we're going to do this for the soldiers. And so I put together, you know, the counselors, the, you know, all the therapists, got bought 14 horses. Horses had to be part of it. And I bought 14 horses that we did trail rides. We used them for therapy. We used them for everything. When one was having a meltdown, we'd send them down to the barn to brush them, you know, just to pat them or brush them or whatever. And they'd be down there talking to them, you know, when we weren't riding. And then they had to learn how to control their adrenaline, which they learn, you know, in combat. And controlling, when we go on trail rides, control your adrenaline with your, you know, riding with your wife, enjoy the scenery, you know, because they all want to run. They all want to run. They all want to go down on the beach and run because there was the lake that was near here. And so we used them a lot of ways. And so the horses were a huge part of this. And Mr. Perot was just, you know, he was gung-ho. He came several times to meet the soldiers during the retreats. We had about 500 soldiers come during, you know, it was full week, 7 days, 7 day retreat, and no kids. And it was all counselors. Every one of the staff were Vietnam veterans. So they were all, you know, they could relate and
understand
so
each other.
Understand. And they would talk to veterans where they wouldn't talk to outsiders. And I was accepted because I was the wife of, and I understood what the wives could relate with me because I understood what they were going through also. But it was, that was the best thing I've ever done in my life. And that all started with when I was living in Honduras. I lived in Honduras for 5 years with my husband. And I found in the middle of the jungle, we were hacking through the jungle, and there's this concrete just plate, you know, on the ground in the middle of the jungle. And it said, "What we have done for ourselves alone dies with us. What we have done for others and the world remains and is immortal." I mean, where do you see that? In the middle of the jungle, you know, the rainforest in Honduras. And it was meant for me to see it.
That is so beautiful. And what you're doing with the horse,
cool?
That's so rewarding. And that kind of transitions me to my next question. What is it about quarter horses specifically you think is so special, not only in the arena, but as you see outside mm-hmm. of the arena, helping people recover?
The quarter horse has the best disposition. You know, look at all the events the quarter horse can be in. But with the kids, my grandkids, my 4-year-old grandson, I just put a tiny little bitty saddle on Maverick and just turned him loose. And they know how to take care, and they have the disposition. They're not crazy. They have that kind eye. They're a very good horse to rely on and be a dependable. You know, they've been the ranch horses forever. They're just very dependable, kind, and yeah, you can trust them.
So, Teresa, my last question for you, can you tell us your favorite funny quarter horse story? This could be a moment in the ring, something you just experienced on the ranch, maybe a funny story about Maverick.
When my sister and I were each other's competition, you know, we were only 2 years apart, and all we did was live with the horses. I mean, I have 3 brothers, but the 2 of us were the horse girls. And my brothers didn't really care about horses. And we would go to the barn barefoot, you know, ride horses barefoot, ride with them bareback, ride with them, you know, sometimes a halter, some whatever. And we would ride. There was a great big pear tree in the back of the ranch. And we would stand underneath it and stand up on the horses barefoot, because you had to be barefoot, or you know, to get up there and stand up and pull pears and feed them to the horses, because horses love the pears. Who knew horses love pears? You know, it would always be apples and stuff like that. But yeah, that was the best time of my life, I think, when my sister, we used to go down to the barn and lay on the back of the horses in the stalls and do our homework. But you know, horses, especially the quarter horse, you know, you could do that. You know, you could do all that stuff when you're a kid and growing up and, you know, do everything. Some, you know, just about all of them, you can go play in the pond, except for Maverick.
Except for Maverick. But similarly, Maverick. Teresa, I used to run away and sleep in my quarter horse's stall. You know, we would mm-hmm. back him up to the pond and do cannonballs off his rump. I mean, they really are just the best.
And I know.
Teresa, I have to thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining us today. You are truly an inspiration across every facet. You know, not only are you still kicking butt and taking names at, you know, you're also leaving an incredible legacy for helping military families. And we can't wait to see how you and Maverick do at the AQHA Select Worlds show. You'll have to let us know. Maybe we'll have you come back and give us the scoop.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you.
When the fall winds howl and the shadows spook even the steadiest horse, Chewy has the seasonal support you need. From calming supplements to help take the edge off, to vitamin E and ration balancers for changing fall pastures, to ice boots and metabolic care for laminitis-prone horses, we've got you covered. And in coolers and blankets to help keep them cozy on chilly nights, and you're ready for any fright this season brings. With trusted brands, fast shipping, and free delivery on orders over $49, Chewy makes it easy. No tricks, just treats for you and your horse. Shop now at chewy.com/equine.
While Teresa Goforth shows us that the partnership with a horse deepens with our age, our next guest, Malin Malin, shows us that the incredible depth of that bond can transcend sight itself. Malin, known as Lady Malin, is a legally blind horse breeder and trainer from Sweden. She manages a large horse family, and her unique condition hasn't been a hindrance, but rather an advantage. This forces her to rely on feel, energy, and an absolute trust in her partners. She's proven that success comes from the heart, not vision, whether she's raising her foals in the forest or competing in show jumping by letting her horse guide the way. Malin's story is a profound look at how the connection between horse and human goes far beyond what we can see, relying instead on a language of mutual understanding.
Malin, how does being legally blind deepen your connection and ability to read your horses in ways that other people might miss?
I think it has to do with the feeling. Because I'm legally blind, I use my hands a lot. So often when I train the foals and the horses, I keep my hands on them. And I feel if they tense up and or anything like that. And I think it's possible actually to miss it when you only use your eye, because a horse can get really tense really fast, but it always doesn't show. But when you use the hands, you actually feel it. So that can make me really exact while I'm training.
That makes a lot of sense for me. I often, you know, see a horse in a pasture and they can feel just a fly land on them. They're these big beasts, but they are so sensitive. And so using your hands as another sensory input really makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I use my fingertips. And then I sense what they are kind of feeling. And that's how we communicate and how I adapt the training. If a foal tense up, I choose to back off a little bit instead of increase anything. Because I always work as a team. So the foal needs to be with me all the way.
That makes a lot of sense. It's very beautiful to me. Can you describe how you use any other senses to assess the horse's movements and mood?
I listen, of course, and I'm legally blind, so of course I see. It's when it's far away, then I can see if it's a camel or a donkey or whatever it is. But when I'm really close, I can see pretty good. But when it's far distance, I listen to how the step sounds, actually, when they are moving. Or if we are stopping or anything like that. And I kind of can feel the energy that we have.
So how do you train a horse to be a guide? Or is that unique partnership a natural extension of the trust you build with them?
That's actually natural, because I haven't trained Lavendel to be a guide horse. It kind of was when she was a foal, she came up to me in the pasture. I put my hand on her and I asked her, shall we go for a walk? Can you see that I don't stumble over any trees or something? And then we just kept walking. So I haven't trained her to do that. It was something she kind of just did and still do. And also Lily and Billy have started. They think it's fun walking me around in the pasture, so we continue doing that.
I love it. You know, instead of you taking the horse for a walk, they're taking you for a walk. I think that would be fun for most horses.
Exactly. Always ends up in the hay table.
So I understand that you run a stable of over 10 horses that you call your horse family. Can you tell me about some of your daily joys and challenges of managing a family this size?
Yes, 11, actually.
Oh, update.
Yeah. Exactly, and one on the way.
Ooh, so congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's Lavendel that is going to have her second foal, and I'm really excited about this. Yes, I have 6 horses at home that I call my forest horses. The rest of them are with my trainer doing their education. And some of them are also competing. So, and when it comes to the daily joys and struggles. With joys are always going out in the pasture and we meet me and it's kind of kisses and amazing always, I think. I love to be with the horses in the forest. The struggles that I have is that my vision have become a little bit worse. So I kind of stumbles over stuff sometimes in the pasture. And I'm not as strong as I was before. So some of the work has been a little bit too heavy for me, lifting hay and stuff like that. But I think the important thing is to do what you actually can do. So I can take care of the poop that I do every day. But I have someone rolling the wheelbarrow. But it's important for me to do the things that I actually can do and to figure out ways to be a part of it. That's really important for me.
So what is it like when you're relying on some of your horse's abilities in the show ring? How does that look differently when you're competing?
I haven't started competing in reining yet. But when I was a child, I did show jump. And how I did that, I have actually no idea how that worked. It was kind of like up on the horse and let's go. My father and I always used to walk and look at the obstacles before I competed. And my horse Star, she kind of knew what to do because I couldn't count in the obstacles. She did that all on her own. So we was a great team, actually. She was a great horse. And I trusted her very much, of course.
So I have to ask, what is drawing you to try reining? We actually just had on, before you joined us, Teresa Goforth, who is a 75-year-old woman competing in reining. And our theme today is incredible riders and their quarter horses. So I have to know, what's pulling you to the reining arena?
From the beginning, it was kind of like I wanted to have a Western horse. And I got a lot of movies of horses, quarter horses. And I thought, oh my God, we are all spinning in circles and doing funny stuff. I have no idea what that is. And that was raining. Then I have always liked speed. If I hadn't been legally blind, I'm pretty sure I would have a lot of cars competing. And what I love about reining more is that it's kind of like speed, but control speed. And you have to have a willing horse that enjoys actually to compete. So I think it's a really beautiful sport and a really beautiful connection between rider and horse, actually, that shows a great relationship. Yes.
You are very brave. I do not go that fast. Ashley knows I like to just walk and trot. That's about it. But reining is beautiful.
Yes, it is. And one day I might be competing. I have some beautiful competition horses and it would actually be really fun to show Sparven someday. So,
well, we're cheering you on. We're your biggest fans.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much.
So, Mullet, our last question for you. We ask all of our guests, what's your favorite funny quarter horse story? It could be in the arena, could be just working, what's just around the barn, but what makes you chuckle?
Oh, my God. Funny quarter horse story.
I know. This is the hardest question we ask.
The one horse that actually make me fun things every day is Trash. He always do something stupid. He kind of runs around in the pasture and all of a sudden he kind of do like a slide stops and tips all over. When he gets up on his feet, looking around, did anyone see me? And he throws his head and he is so cute. I think, Trash is the one that do make me smile, actually.
Oh, he sounds adorable. That's hilarious. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today. And we're all rooting for you when you get in the reining pen.
Thank you so much for having me.
And joining me now is one of my favorite coworkers here at Equine Network, Jillian Eberlein. And she is not only a fellow quarter horse girly, she's also freshly back from Congress. Welcome to the show, Jillian.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to come on and kind of get to tell you what happened at this year's Congress.
Well, before we get there, I have to tell our listeners all about your horse. He's my favorite horse of all my coworkers at Equine Network. And first, I just want you to tell everyone his registered name, please.
Dad's Private Jet.
And what do I call him?
Ashley has taken it upon herself to call him Daddy.
I do.
His bar name is not Daddy.
I think my
trainers would kick me out. His bar name is Shiloh. But every time I send Ashley a video, she'll text me saying, "How's Daddy?" And it gets weird looks. Some people look over my shoulders.
Just imagine it, guys. She's entering the ring, and here comes Jillian riding Daddy. Like, come on. Come on. It's too good. So tell us about how you came to get Shiloh and how you really got into quarter horses in the first place.
Yeah. So I started off in the hunter jumper land up in New York City, where I was born and raised. And I went to college in West Virginia. And when I started the IHSA team, all the horses in our barn were quarter horses. And honestly, I didn't really know much about quarter horses. No one in my area had them. Every time I thought of a quarter horse, I thought Western, rodeo, all that kind of stuff. So when I joined the team, started riding quarter horses, and I was like, wait, this is kind of nice. I was like, they do more than just the Western. And I really just fell in love with their personalities, the way that they move. And I just loved how they're very forgiving. They're pretty tried and true. And yes, they spook. Yes, they have their moments. But I really feel like most of them try their best to be as good as possible. And they don't really hold a grudge, which is something I loved. So from there, I ended up moving down to Ocala, Florida, and finding a barn down here. And I decided that now's time that I want to find my first quarter horse. So I went through my trainers, and we ended up finding Daddy in Texas. And shipped him from Texas down to Ocala, where he's been in training for the past few months. And the goal with him is to do the showmanship, the driving, and the over fences. I really want him to be a versatility king, if he can be. So, yeah, I'm really excited just to kind of have my first horse ever and really learn with him. And, yeah, he's going to be really cool. I'm excited.
It sounds like you've got the right guy for the job. We always, you know, we go on and on here on the Quarter Horse Podcast about their versatility. And all of our guests, I would say, when we ask what their favorite thing is about a quarter horse, is their personality and their willingness. You know, I always think that they're like the golden retrievers of the horse world. They're just showing up for their job with a smile on, like, okay, what are we doing today?
Yeah. I mean, every time I walk in the barn or I walk into a stall, he's like, "Mom, can I have pets now? Like, I just want attention." And I'm like, he is genuinely a golden retriever.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I'm so glad I have two dogs and they are both the same personality. Like, if he could come home with me, I think he would. I think he would love to live in my apartment with me.
I mean, I'm sure that cross-training him to go up and down stairs into an apartment building would be really great for his training.
I think so, too. And I think it'd really build his top line and give him more of a booty.
I think there's nothing that can go wrong here. Nope. Full send.
I mean, or the elevator. We'll figure it out.
Okay. And then
get up here.
Before we go to Congress, I just need you to tell everybody how beautiful Daddy is. I mean, he's literally like Black Beauty, Black
Tall,
Stallion.
Dark and handsome.
Oh, like jet black.
Mm-hmm.
Just
16-3. Little bit of white on his face, long tail. He's really filling out. He's going through that like awkward growth. But
because he's three coming four. That's what I thought. Yep.
And you see him and you're just like, he's handsome.
Oh, he
once
is.
Once again, tall, dark, and handsome. Ugh. I'm just like, ooh, that's mine.
Oh, wow. Daddy holds a very special place in my heart, and I always love getting your updates. But let's talk now a little bit about Congress. I know you said you were going to watch some friends compete. Tell me about what you saw, the vibes, everything.
Yeah, so the barn I'm at now and the barn I went to while in college were both competing. So I got to see old friends, new friends.
Fun.
And it was really great. So they did a bunch of the youth stuff, the youth over fences, equitation, hack. We had a few people do the working hunter under saddle. We had someone do the lunge line. We had someone do the western. So really got a view of everything. And honestly, what I really saw was, which is something I find in the quarter horse industry overall, is the support that everybody has for each other. Whether you're in the same class and you're supposed to be competitors and, you know, you're all for yourself, not all for yourselves, but really just wanting to win yourself. Like when a placing would get announced, everyone would cheer, even if it wasn't someone from their barn. And I really love to see how much the community supports each other and how trainers will step in and not step on toes, but just be like, hey, let's try this. Or, you know, after we're done, let's school this and let's try to figure out what might have gone wrong. I don't want to say inspiring, but really nice to see, because that's not something you really hear about often, is how friendly people really are and how they really do want the best for not only the rider, but for the horse. So that was really nice to see. And like I said, a lot of hugging and a lot of people going up to each other, like the youth kids slapping each other on the back and just be like, wow, you did it. Like, you know, running to get pictures for them and really being their biggest cheerleaders was something that always amazes me every year at Congress.
That makes a lot of sense, because you and I both come from an English background, and it's not always like that at the Hunter Jumper shows, you know, at the A Circuit shows. There's a lot more yelling than smiling sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's for sure. I remember, like I said, when I got into quarter horses, that was just something that I was like, why is everyone so nice? I was like, is this like a joke? Like, are they going to stab me in the back right now?
Sure.
Should I run? I'm like, okay, we're just friends with everyone. And they're like, yeah, why wouldn't we be? I was like, oh, okay, I'm scared, but I'm kind of liking this.
Oh, I love that. So I know some of my favorite thing, and this is more on the Western side of Congress, but I love the fashion, the bling bling, the prints. Did you see any like super fun, hot fashion while you were there?
A lot of cheetah.
Yes.
This year.
Yes.
A lot of cheetah. I'm loving like the cropped jackets that riders are wearing.
I think they're so cute too.
And I was just, the suits for showmanship, you know, loving that. And I mean, when they walked by, I was just like, oh my God. I'm like, why can't we do this with the English stuff? Like, imagine jumping and having just a bunch of rhinestones on us. I mean, what could go wrong?
I mean, I think we should bring all the prints, all the rhinestones.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I mean, the trainers might not like it, but it would be fun.
Oh,
imagine going
man.
To the barn with a loud saddle pad. Your trainer would be like, turn around and leave.
or yeah, in the dressage world, could you imagine, like, LOLOL?
They would probably throw it out in front of you.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even ask you to leave.
Nope. They would just stop talking. You would turn around. You would just be shunned. You would be kicked out and ignored.
Never to be seen or heard from again.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Jillian, this is so fun to have you on the show. I'm so glad we can finally make Daddy a famous podcast horse.
Finally.
And, you know, we'll have to have you back on and give us an update on his training. Maybe we'll do another Hunter Jumper episode sometime next year.
Yeah, anytime.
Yay.
I'll get the trainers to give me some pointers on what to call out. Because I'm like, I don't know. He looks great to me. He always looks great.
He does. It's a good problem to have.
Thanks so much for tuning into the Quarter Horse Podcast on Horses in the Morning. Be sure to like, subscribe, and tell all your friends about the world's favorite breed of horse.